Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, October 11th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And as always, each week, I do want to thank those of you who continue to support the show. Remember, Talk Nerdy is, and since the beginning, in all the way back in 2014, it's always been 100% free to download, and that's because I do rely on the support of individuals just like you. If you want to pledge your support, you've just got to visit patreon.com/talknerdy to learn more. This week's top patrons include Rob Schreck, Daniel Lang, Mary Neva, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, David J.E. Smith, June Sapara, Ulrika Hagman, and Robert Christ. Thank you all so, so much. All right, let's talk about what we have on deck for you this week. I had the opportunity to sit down virtually, still not sitting down in person, with Dr. Andy Norman. Now, Andy is a philosopher. He directs the Humanism Initiative at Carnegie Mellon University. He's also the founder of the Cognitive Immunology Research Collaborative. And what that is sort of explained and encapsulated within his new book. It's called Mental Immunity, Infectious Ideas, Mind Parasites, and the Search for a Better Way to Think. So without any further ado, we are going to talk all about the antidote to disinformation, propaganda, division, pseudoscience, post-truth, non-truth, conspiracy theories, all that jazz. How can we develop immunity to bad ideas? Here with some answers for us is Dr. Andy Norman. Well, Andy, thank you so much for joining me today.
That's a pleasure to be here, Cara. Thank you.
All right. So I am excited to talk about your new book, Mental Immunity, Infectious Ideas, Mind Parasites, and the Search for a Better Way to Think. I think anybody who, you know, has stuck with me for these, what are we at, like 7 years now on Talk Nerdy knows that anytime we get to talk about critical thinking, anytime we get to talk about kind of non-science, pseudoscience, you know, questioning, and especially this, gosh, this sort of post-truth era that we find ourselves in right now, it's a good conversation. So, of course, when your book came across my desk, I was like, yep, let's do this. This is so important.
Yeah, well, it's hard to deny that we need to take critical thinking to a new level, given our level of connectivity these days, right?
Right. So tell me a little bit before we dive into the book itself about kind of, you know, where your expertise falls, what kind of training you had, like how did you get into a position where writing a book like this was, you know, important for you?
Yeah. So I was trained in philosophy, and in particular, the branch of philosophy that looks at how science works and how reasoning works. So for about 30 years, I've tried to understand how we reason, why reasoning breaks down when it does, and how we can reason together in more fruitful ways. I'm particularly interested in how you reason with somebody who has a different ideology or somebody who seems ideologically intransigent, and how do you break down that rigidity and actually connect with people in ways that allow you to reconcile your differences. So those are the set of problems I've worked on since the mid-1980s, really.
Gotcha. And where are you working now?
I'm at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. I have a direct and humanism initiative here. But a lot of my time these days goes into writing and promoting this new science of mental immunity that I talk about in the book.
Yeah, so let's dive right into that. This idea of mental immunity, cognitive immunology, like these different ideas are probably kind of new for people when we hear these terms that, you know, I know what physiological immunity is. I know about immunology in our, you know, body's cells, in our organs. What about in our minds?
Yeah, so the basic idea is that there's a very strong analogy between the two domains. So in the same way that our bodily immune systems protect us against infectious microbes, usually by marshaling antibodies to fight off those microbes. In exactly that same way, our minds actually have immune systems that marshal doubts to try to fight off infectious ideas, or not just not just infectious ideas, but any idea that might harm us or mislead us.
So the analogy here is that instead of like a microorganism, a bacterium, a virus, a protist, something like that, that could potentially infect us, it's an idea, but potentially a detrimental idea.
And this is an idea that a lot of people need some time to get their head around. But cognitive scientists who study the problem are coming around to the idea that bad ideas really are mind parasites. So a parasite requires a host. An idea requires a host. A parasite can infect its host and get it to spread copies to other hosts, to other bodies. And a bad idea can infect a mind and get it to spread the idea to other minds, right?
As we've seen left, right, and center recently.
All over the place, right?
Yeah, yeah. And of course, social media and different platforms that, you know, I contend, and I'm interested in your thoughts, but I've long contended that this idea of misinformation, of post-truth thinking, of fake news, of, you know, propaganda, pseudoscience, all the different sort of words we could put in a word cloud to describe what we're dealing with right now, none of this is new. This has been happening since the beginning of time. The big difference is that our voices are much more amplified now, and we're able to connect to people across a globe. We're able to find people who are like-minded. So it's no longer like the village crier. Now we're seeing that there are individuals on the internet finding each other in chat rooms.
Yeah, it's certainly true that you can go back in history and find that there are epidemics of propaganda, you know, epidemics of kooky thinking have happened throughout human history, and propaganda and, the spread of rigid ideologies. Partisanship has torn nations apart before it landed in, you know, contemporary America. So none of those things are new. You're quite right about that. But I think not only has the internet handed everybody a soapbox, a soapbox that can reach thousands or millions with social media, not only that, maybe this is a different way of saying the same thing, but we're much more connected digitally. And in the same way that, you know, intimate human connections can allow viruses to spread through a population, more digital connections make it easier for bad ideas to spread through populations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like we've seen waves of pandemics, in the past, and we can point to why they took hold in certain areas and why they spread with the advent of the, you know, airplane, or with, we know that the Spanish flu, the reason it circled the globe was because we were in the midst of a war and there were soldiers who were going from nation to nation. And so, yeah, as our technology improves and gets us more connected physically, of course, the germs can spread more readily, and we're seeing the same thing happening now with these mental germs.
So imagine, Kara, if the designers of the internet had foreseen that, you know, outbreaks of viral nonsense might rampage across the internet and lead to genocides, as has already happened in some countries. Facebook has been used to mobilize genocide in Sri Lanka, I believe, and
Myanmar.
Malaysia.
We've seen some
Myanmar,
really,
And of course, social media has just ramped up the partisanship in America as well. And it's anybody's guess as to whether America will survive the stresses that social media is putting on it. So we seem to have unleashed something we don't know how to control. And the point of my book is to say, you know, in the same way that the science of immunology allowed us to bring smallpox under control, in the exact same way, we can take the science of cognitive immunology, the idea that information can spread in an epidemiological fashion, and actually learn how to strengthen our mind's immune systems. So vaccines strengthen our bodily immune systems so that we can survive things like smallpox and diphtheria and cholera and polio. And I think that the right kind of instruction can inoculate our minds against conspiracy thinking and science denial and rigid, truculent ideologies.
You know, one of the things that's been such a difficult quandary for me as a public communicator of science and as somebody who is very much dialed into the kind of scientific skeptic movement, who, you know, speaks on these topics and works, of course, in the other podcast I work on, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, in a pretty significant way. One of the things I've been grappling with most recently is this idea of, how do you inoculate, or how do you maybe recover if you can't inoculate, if they're sort of, they're too far down the course, when somebody doesn't appreciate that scientific, or maybe let's throw the word scientific out of the mix, but that critical thinking actually is important, like when they themselves don't have a motivation to think critically.
Right. And that's in some ways the hardest case that we have to deal with, right? Everyone else, at least you have a starting point for some common ground to build on.
Absolutely. Like when I argue with my father, who is, he's a Mormon, two-time Trump voter living in Texas, who is actually a very brilliant man, who in many ways I get along with very well, but we have very, very different views on race relations in this country. We have very different views on a lot of kind of moral philosophy. But we can almost always find common ground because he values critical thinking and science. And so I always feel lucky that even though in some respects I think of my father, for example, as having kind of fallen victim to certain types of thinking, especially when it comes to religion, which is sort of like what I view as like a culturally acceptable way to think a certain way, or politics, right? But at its core, he's not a QAnon conspiracy theorist. He's not so far gone that I feel like we can't always find common ground because he respects thinking.
Yeah. And I think there's always grounds for hope when you respect thinking. And some of these QAnon followers, I mean, it's the level of sort of self-deceit or whatever it is that's going on is almost mind-boggling. I actually think that the right way to understand what's going on with QAnon is that certain social and cultural pressures have actually caused many mental immune systems to collapse. That in the same way that your body's immune system can become compromised and fail to come to your body's defense, your mind can actually be compromised in a way that prevents your mind's defenses from protecting it against bad ideas. And once your mind starts to fill up with some bad ideas, they tend to attract others of their kind, and you can get kind of a runaway snowball effect.
Yeah, that reminds me of like one of David Dunning, of the Dunning-Kruger effects, most famous sort of quotes that I go back to, and I'm paraphrasing because I'm not going to quote him verbatim, but like that the mind isn't blank. It's not like you learn new things and they just situate into a black hole. When you're learning new things, you're connecting them to all the garbage that's already in there. And a lot of it is probably, mistruths. A lot of it probably is not reflective of reality.
And I think that underscores the importance of the ability to unlearn. Right, the ability to do what I call subtractive learning. So we have this mental picture of learning. It's about a matter of taking in information and sort of adding to the mind's knowledge stockpile. But in the book, I argue that is at best only one of three important dimensions of learning. You need to add knowledge and information, but you need to subtract out the fake news and the alternative facts, and you need to subtract out the confusion. You need to subtract out the things that aren't clear enough. You need to subtract out the ideas that actually turn us bitter and hateful, right? There are lots of criteria we can bring to bear on ideas that aren't serving us well. And really robust mental immunity involves knowing how to apply all of those standards to kind of refine our belief systems. I mentioned three things: adding, subtracting, but you also need to organize the contents of your mind.
Yeah. So sort of we know that part of the way that the human mind really works, especially from a more cog psych perspective, is that we connect things to other things, or as we unlearn things even, we have to figure out how they make sense to us. Oh, that reminds me of this other thing that I learned, and that's why this is now a more robust thought. Or, you know, so is that sort of what you mean when you talk about the sort of organization?
Yeah, well, I liken it to gardening. In the same way that the best gardeners both plant beautiful, you know, they both seed a beautiful plants, but also weed ugly weeds. but they also arrange the plantings into beautiful and useful arrangements. And I think that if you want a worldview worth sharing, you need to do all of those things. You need to yank cognitive weeds. You need to plant beautiful ideas and knowledge structures. And you need to organize your thoughts in ways that provide clarity and insight. And none of those things is automatic.
And I think even extending your metaphor, you also need to, even if you've planted something beautiful and it's well organized and you've pulled all the weeds, you still have to prune the beautiful things. Like as you're learning, things change and you have to update, even if you knew something to be true. I see this all the time with, you know, my mother's husband, for example, got a biology degree. He works in IT now, but he got a biology degree in like the 80s. And so the things that he was taught in school, we know to be different now. And if you don't sort of update your thinking and you stick to old ideas, even if they're right, or they were right, then, you know, you're going to be overgrown in your garden.
I love your expansion of my metaphor there to include the pruning of beautiful and useful plants. And let me try an example on you here and tell me what you think. I think people have human rights. I think we all have rights. And among our rights is the right to freedom. But if you accept that in a very crude face value way, you might assume that that means you can do whatever you damn please. But of course, philosophers have long known that if your freedoms start to infringe on my freedoms, that's where your freedoms end. I think the one way of saying this is that my freedom to swing my fist ends at the tip of your nose.
Right, right.
And you know, speech rights are important, but you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. So it turns out this is true of all rights. They all have limits. And yet there are many people, Americans today, who are screaming bloody murder as though encouragement to get a vaccine is somehow an infringement on their rights.
Or to wear a mask, even. Yeah.
I think there's some pruning of their concept of rights needs to happen there.
You're right, because of course, this shows that there was a level of knowledge and a level of education, learning about the Bill of Rights, learning about, you know, our Constitution, but a sort of, and then it just grew from there and was never sort of checked, right? And I think checking ourselves, again, pruning those overgrown branches requires a certain refinement. It also requires a nuance, as any gardener knows. This leaf's a little brown. Maybe I need to cut it because it'll help the others. But if I cut too many, then maybe it's going to actually stress the plant beyond. It's operating in the gray is not easy for a lot of people.
I think that's part of it. And then when people feel scared and insecure, I think simple certitudes provide comfort, even though they're misleading. So think about the libertarian who argues property rights are absolute. Taxation deprives me of my property against my will. Therefore, all taxation is wrong. Now, if you take that reasoning to be valid without exception, you instantly deprive all governments of ways to generate revenue and basically stay in business. You basically have to recognize that property rights have limits. I mean, if I buy the house next door and build a 75-foot neon sign next to you, you're gonna have an issue with me, right? And I can't argue, hey, that's my property. I can do with it what I want.
Yeah. I see often the argument going around the internet when people do kind of claim the more libertarian arguments for why they don't want to get vaccinated or wear a mask. And you'll see the rebuttals will say something like, okay, so you have the right to drink all the alcohol you want. Nobody's going to stop you. Nobody's going to, you know, you can sit in your house and get as drunk as you want to and get as sick as you want to from the alcohol. But the minute you get behind the wheel, that right stops because it infringes on my right to safety.
That's a perfect really what example. Right?
That's like what, to me, what not getting vaccinated does.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Not getting vaccinated turns you into somebody who's dangerous to your fellow citizens. And it boggles my mind that so many Americans can't see that or appreciate that. And it's dark times in some ways that people are so dug in and unwilling to give an inch on that.
I'm interested in your take on this idea. We discussed this recently on the other podcast I work on, this idea of active versus passive risk. And that really, it resonated with me quite a lot. And I've actually been using it in therapy with some of my patients. I work with a lot of very, very sick patients in a large cancer center doing psychotherapy. And one of the things that we quite talked about is how it almost feels evolutionarily beneficial to us, or for whatever reason, we have this cognitive bias where doing nothing feels safer and less risky than doing something active. And so the idea that if I just don't get vaccinated,
right,
my chance of catching COVID is, you know, whatever. If I do get vaccinated, now I'm actively doing something that maybe will cause harm, even though when you look at the actual statistics, we know getting vaccinated is significantly less, like orders of magnitude less dangerous than walking around without a vaccine.
And I'm more familiar with a comparable distinction in ethics between sins of omission and sins of commission. So when you do something that harms, that seems almost everybody to have a bad side. But if you fail to act in ways that prevent harm, people sometimes have different intuitions about that.
You're right. Yeah. This idea that sort of passively letting things happen seems somehow less it's less risky, but actively doing things, even if the evidence show, even if statistically we understand that doing the active thing is the best way to prevent harm, it's harder for people to wrap their heads around that.
It is, but I think, you know, if you explore examples in a good ethics class, for example, and really get a chance to dwell and feel the force of, you know, how would you feel if you ended up on the short end of the stick because somebody else failed to, you know, do something simple to protect you? Well, okay, I guess I'm trying to think of an example that involves your passive.
Right, right. Yeah, it's like the vaccine is the one that I always keep coming up with. Yeah.
I was reading an article just a couple of days ago about an employer who had mandated the virus, sorry, the vaccine, and an employee, or I guess several employees, were objecting that they were applying for a religious exemption on the grounds that the vaccine had employed stem cells derived from a human embryo, and the very clever employer basically came up with a little sort of exit interview that they're saying, okay, do you understand that I assume you also have objections to ibuprofen and Tylenol and all these other things because they were developed using fetal tissue as well. And apparently a few genuinely religiously motivated objectors to the vaccine said, yes, I can't use those medicines either now that I know this, right?
But they wanted to maintain this sort of internal consistency.
Right. But that was the exception. Many more just got angry and said, you know, quit trying to browbeat me into taking away my freedoms.
And that's one of those tough positions that we often find ourselves in. I mean, my assumption right now, and maybe it's an unfair one, but I think that my listenership, there's obviously a selection bias here. So my assumption is that the 99% of the listeners are the ones who are like, how do I convince my grandfather? They're not the ones who are like, I need convincing. But that really becomes one of the tougher questions. You know, I think we often sit around and go, why do people, why can't people? Oh, I'm so frustrated by the fact that people, you know, fill in the blank. But many people are finding themselves in a real moral conundrum right now because they're like, I, for example, can't invite so-and-so over to visit my home because I have a child who's unvaccinated and I want to be nice, but at the same time, you know, this isn't political anymore. This isn't religious anymore. This isn't whatever. This is it's a public health issue. And so, you know, what kind of, I guess, advice or obviously this is a bigger process, mental immunity. It's not a quick fix, but how do people start to grapple with this within their communities?
Yeah. So a couple of things. And I think you made an allusion to this earlier. Turns out it's easier to prevent a mind infection than to cure one. Now some mind infections, if I think so-and-so's car was blue and somebody says, no, it was a dark green. I go, okay. And I replace that mistaken idea with the true one and without any fuss. But for many, especially politically or religiously or ethically motivated beliefs, it can get much harder to let go.
Yeah. Especially when somebody is, as we might say, quote, entrenched.
Exactly. And if you can teach the right kind of critical thinking skills early enough, and so that the stubbornly change resistant ideologies never take root, it's relatively easy then to educate that person. But once that ideology has sunk roots, people become resistant to any information that threatens their identity. And it turns out that the mind kind of freaks out. Information that threatens your identity can cause your mind's immune system to overreact and attack it, the same way your body's immune system can overreact and attack healthy tissues. So part of the trick here is to upgrade our educational system so that the principles of what I call cognitive immunology, the principles of mental immunity, are just built into the way we educate children. And that can reduce the size of the misinformation problem, our problem with divisive ideologies, I think, by an order of magnitude with the right changes in education. Mm-hmm. But then you still have the problem of how do you help people who've already, you know, fallen in with QAnon or who've become invested in the idea that climate change is a hoax? How do you reach them? And again, that's harder work. It can be emotionally difficult work, right? Because those conversations can be really difficult. But there are some fascinating stories about what works here. My friend Lee McIntyre has just written a book called How to Talk to a Science Denier. And he surveys the research about, what do those who are really successful at talking across ideological divides do? Have you heard of Daryl Davis, the blues musician who deconverted a bunch of Klansmen?
No. How did he do it?
Amazing. Yeah, he was having a beer at a bar where he was playing music, and a guy comes up to him and says, man, you've actually learned some of the blues riffs of Jerry Lee Lewis. He said, you black guys are, pretty good imitations of Jerry Lee Lewis. And Daryl looked at him and he says, that Jerry Lee Lewis learned from the black master blues musicians, right? And this guy, who turned out to be a grand cyclops of the KKK, didn't know this about blues music. And they talked long enough so that they decided to meet again. And Daryl tells the story much better than I can, But he, over a series of meetings, basically got the guy to realize that his prejudices, his white supremacist ideology, didn't make any sense. And he did it primarily—
like it wasn't rooted in reality.
Well, he did it primarily by listening to the guy. Without getting defensive, without getting angry, he just listened to the guy and let this guy come to the realization that his own ideology didn't make sense. I think a lot of the most ideologically confused people just don't have a chance to articulate their views clearly and actually hear themselves think.
I think that's common, and you hear that a lot from people who do, quote, argue on the internet, that they'll get frustrated when they're talking to a, quote, denier, because there will be circular reasoning, or there will usually be a point in which they just get frustrated. I see this a lot with my father, where we'll be arguing about a very entrenched view that he might have gotten from Fox News. And if I can respond to each of his claims, like we'll talk about abortion, and he'll say, well, of course, I just don't think people should be able to get third trimester abortions. And I'm like, do you understand how uncommon that is? And I'll cite the literature. And then he'll say, but I don't think that. And I'll say, okay, but you realize that this is how. And then at a certain point, very often he'll be like, I can't keep up with this. I don't want to talk about this anymore. There's this shutdown moment where I almost feel his own frustration with himself.
Yeah. And I imagine that you're very good at, you know, bringing relevant considerations to his attention.
Absolutely. At sort of empathizing with where he's coming from in his arguments and using examples that feel salient to him.
And people have to want to change their minds. You have to kind of give them reason. There's a phenomenon called motivational interviewing, where there's a way to question somebody that brings their own motivations for growth out, and a really skilled motivational interviewer can use that knowledge to get the person to realize that they themselves have work to do to modify their worldview, to update their worldview. I think Daryl's a master at this. But it's the kind of thing that takes practice in a lot of cases, right? I had the good fortune of being able to just teach really interesting and potentially divisive issues in ethics and philosophy of religion and political philosophy every day for 25 years. And so I got a ton of practice just facilitating constructive conversations where everybody was respected, and we together just valued what we could learn from one another. I taught people how to really listen to one another. And when you practice it, these difficult conversations become far less difficult.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so much of that, like you mentioned, is listening. It's empathizing. It's kind of like the kid in the class who has his hand up the whole time, and you finally call on him and he asks the question. You're like, bro, I just answered that question. Like, you were so intent on asking your question, you weren't even listening to what I was saying. And we all do that. I mean, that's a very human way to be, and we have to fight against it.
I do think listening skills are way more important than our educational system realizes. I studied mediation with a guy who pointed out that of the four main communication modalities, namely writing, reading, speaking, and listening, listening is the one we do the most, but the one we teach the least.
Interesting. Yeah. We don't. We just assume everybody knows how to do it.
Yeah. And it turns out there are, you can take listening to hold different levels by paying really close attention to what the person, so the underlying motive, if you can discern the underlying motivations behind the words and sympathize with those, you're doing a higher level kind of listening. And you can affirm that a lot of times a person's underlying motives and just say, I really like what you're trying to do here, but I'm not sure I'd use the exact same words. What if we tried it like this? And that's a far less threatening way to kind of get somebody to rethink something, right?
Well, and such a common practice in psychotherapy, like I find myself doing all the time, because I'm much more like existentially humanistically oriented within my psychotherapeutic work. That's an actual kind of like school of thinking. And a common thing that I find myself doing is saying like something like, I'm hearing blah, blah, blah. Is that a good way to conceptualize what you're telling me?
Nice.
Because sometimes, you know, the words aren't quite capturing what you just said, the sort of what's happening underneath the words. But if I can then say, oh, this is what I'm hearing, this is my takeaway. But then, of course, to reflect back and be like, am I off base? Because I can't just assume.
And when you come back to somebody and say, hey, this is what I'm hearing, do I really understand you? You're communicating something really important. You're communicating that you care enough to really understand the person. Which is something almost everybody feels a desperate need for these days. Everybody, we've got a world, right, where everybody has a soapbox, everybody's talking, and nobody feels like they're listening to them, being listened to. If you just give somebody the gift of your full attention for a while, it can be really powerful. And if you show that you're willing to listen and learn from somebody else, generally, they'll eventually realize that they can listen and learn from you.
Yeah, and it would be interesting if a big part, I mean, it probably is very true, you're right, that a big part of sort of the, quote, pathology of deeply entrenched conspiracy thinking is a desperate attempt to be heard.
Ah.
It's a, you know, I have figured something out that nobody else has access to. Please hear me, because I have the solution to a world problem.
And I think being in on a big secret that all the sheeple out there are blind to has got to be a really seductive thought, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think personally, and this is my atheist bias coming through, but I think it also underlies the reason that religion can be so powerful for so many people, that we're in a club, we know the true truth, we have access to things that are beyond this realm that unless you're in this club, you don't have access to.
And imagine, you know, spending the first, I don't know, 20 years of your life in a family that's teaching you to think that way.
I don't have to imagine it.
Okay. I should just shut up.
I was raised, born and raised Mormon, so I can totally empathize with the point you're making right now.
Well, then you tell me, Kara, how did you step away from those beliefs, or were they actually beliefs?
Yeah, so that I think is one of those important questions. And, you know, this is interesting coming from a psychology, neuroscience, you know, melded with a philosophy perspective, our sort of intersubjectivity that we're sharing right now in this conversation. I'm interested in your takeaway from what I'm about to say. I've often grappled with the idea that, you know, not only are we not blank, you know, we're not tabula rasa, clearly we're raised in a culture and we're raised to have certain prejudices and biases and thoughts based on the state we grew up in and the city and the family and the religion and all of those things. But I also sometimes wonder about somebody's constitution, about somebody's, we talk about it with dogs all the time. Like you can raise a really lovely pet dog, but some dogs have a certain temperament and you may have to try to train it out of them. And sometimes your training efforts are really, really impactful.
Right, different dog breeds are known for having different temperaments.
Are known for having different temperaments that we can either foster or suppress. And so I say that because I feel like when I was a child, even though I had the exact same experience as some of my siblings, I was resistant to it. And I almost, you know, it's very hard to put myself, to empathize with my historical self. But one of the things I can say is, I don't know if I ever believed what I was being taught. I don't know if I had to.
So you don't remember suffering trauma at having to let go of these.
Right. I mean, it was a very hard, it was traumatic in that there were rifts within the family having to say, I do not identify with this, and having all of the fallout that occurs from that. But this idea of, am I myself? Who have I been this whole life? Is my entire identity shifting? I don't know if I ever experienced that, because I don't know if I was ever caught in that way.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in a pretty liberal home where my folks were like, yeah, you know, go visit all the different religions and see which one you like. And, you know, we support you, whichever one you choose. And I'm grateful for that. But I have an enormous amount of respect for people who grew up and somehow escape oppressive religious ideologies. My hat is off to people who have to think their way out of those kind of traps, because I see, you know, political versions of those same identity traps
Oh, gosh, for sure. People raised in the what we call now the cult of Fox News, like even if it's not religious. And you know what I think, not to take up too much time specifically on this, but one of the things that I want to reinforce, because it's coming up for me kind of emotionally right now, is that one place where I often get frustrated is when friends or family, less so family members, but friends or colleagues or individuals assume that they know that the reason I'm an atheist is because I was raised Mormon. Like that it's somehow a reaction to how I was raised. Like, oh, either I'm going to become more Mormon or I'm going to eschew it and become a total atheist, as if there's no nuance there. And so the reason I bring this up is because I want to say to anybody listening, like, there's no way to do it. And just because maybe you were raised in an oppressive religion and then you left doesn't mean you're not still struggling. Doesn't mean that you haven't found your halfway point or whatever is meaningful to you. Like your not being religious anymore was not a reaction to being raised religious. It was your journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I imagine, I do think religious beliefs serve psychological and sometimes social needs. And if you abandon that religion, a lot of times there's a God-shaped gap in your life and a need for connection or meaning or significance and if you've been raised to expect that the solutions to those needs have a religious shape and texture, it can be hard to find the thing you really need in secular culture because it just doesn't seem to fit the bill, right?
And some people find that in a very tribal political affiliation or even something that goes beyond that, you know, like the extreme examples, like you were talking about the KKK, which does have religious roots, but that there's sort of a club that you yourself were, quote, lucky enough to be in by virtue of who you are. I think there's an interesting, you know, this brings up for me this idea that I read in Irvin Yalom. So Irvin Yalom, if you're not aware of him, he is a psychiatrist who's sort of often thought of as one of the founders of existential psychotherapy here in the U.S. So this is a big movement in Europe, but he sort of...
I did read one of his novels.
Oh, yeah, he does write novels too. Yeah, he's amazing. And he writes a lot about death. I'm very attracted to his work because I work in end of life. And his major kind of tome, Existential Psychotherapy, he talks about how there are four givens of existence. I've mentioned this on the show before. So he thinks that the reason most people seek therapy or have sort of existential crises or maybe do these deep introspective philosophical journeys is because of fear of death, because of loneliness, because of meaninglessness, and because of the struggle between freedom and responsibility, that these are sort of core existential issues that everybody grapples with, right?
That makes a lot of sense to me. That one aspect of that, I think you called it meaning or something?
Meaninglessness, yeah, right. Or a sense of purpose or meaning, yeah.
Yeah, well, I actually think that the concept of mattering has some real power to kind of unravel some of the philosophical confusions about meaning, the meaningfulness or meaninglessness of life. So do you know Rebecca Goldstein? I'm sure you do.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She and I have each done some work. Hers is far more important and foundational, but she's done some amazing work about sort of the human need to matter and how that has an outsized impact on our behavior and our well-being. And when we don't find a niche for ourselves where we feel like we're making a difference, like we're mattering, you know, the suffering can be really intense.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, I one of the things I often see with adolescent, where I used to work in a foster care setting, and one of the themes that I saw over and over with the adolescents that I worked with was, I feel like an alien. Nobody gets me. I don't fit in. I don't have a place.
So belonging, I think, is right up there with mattering as one of humanity's core needs.
There's so much overlap between the two.
I'm sure they're connected, yeah. I'm sure they matter in at least this way. One of the most tried and true methods of mattering is to make a difference for somebody that matters to you, right? To support or help or show somebody you love that you love them. Right, that's a in a way, I'm not sure mattering gets any more authentic and direct and genuine than that, which means that mattering is in some ways deeply social.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, it almost, well, I don't want to say it flies in the face of some existential thought, because I think a lot of existentialists did get the social component, that it wasn't just I'm alone on this rock.
But that they're, yeah, unless you're with Dostoevsky or Camus or something.
Exactly. But kind of going back to that real quick, this idea that, you know, Yalom talks about all these different things. When he specifically dug into fear of death, which he dedicates half his book to, because it's a big part of his work, and it's a part that resonates deeply with me, that it's very human to be afraid of death. And we do all of these things to try to assuage or mitigate our death anxiety. And he said two of the strategies that are very common are that we have this view of personal acceptance, sort of like everybody else dies, but I'm not going to. And we grapple with that in whatever way we're going to. Many, many people, they won't say that out loud, but if you really start to question them, you see all these denialism, you know, mechanisms that they use. Like, yeah, but I'm going to live, you know, to be old, or oh, but by then we're, you know, there's going to be like a pill for that, you know. So there's all these views that people do. It's like I'm different than other people. And then the other one that he references is the belief in a personal rescuer. And oftentimes it is religious, this idea that we're going to be saved, this idea that we have eternal life, yeah, that there's salvation, all these different things that are religious. But even in secular individuals, we often will find somebody or something that will somehow save us from the terror of death. And it's an interesting... the secular example that he often uses is the role of the therapist, so that he has found himself serving that role with others and having to work on that, that sort of like, Dr. Yalom, you're going to make it so that when I get closer to the end, I don't have to, it's not going to be that painful. You're going, or even just like modern medicine can be viewed sometimes as a sort of savior from the real suffering that we experience.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure it ever occurred to me to go to a therapist to treat fear of death.
I know, right? But it's actually interesting how often it is the kernel underneath what people are anxious about.
I do a little bit of philosophical counseling, which is kind of a thing. Turns out sometimes people's emotional troubles reside from thought structures or assumptions that aren't serving them well. And if if you're a good listener and you know how to ask the right questions, a lot of times you can help them sort out, you know, untangle their thoughts and actually get in touch with the things that really matter to them.
Oh my gosh, I love that. I mean, I think that, you know, for some therapists, that's a big part of their work. Certain cognitive behavioral therapists do a lot of sort of, yeah, cognitive restructuring. And then for myself as a psychotherapist, I take a more, you know, I'm trained in existential psychotherapy. So there is a huge philosophical component to grappling with, you know, the givens of reality and existence. And how cool that those things sort of coalesce that, but I've never heard of philosophical counseling. Can you tell me more about it?
Yeah, well, let's see. So back in ancient Greece, right before he drank his hemlock and died, Socrates argued that philosophy is preparation for death, like somehow kind of thinking through the human condition and understanding yourself is a way of kind of calming your mind and being less frightened in the face of death. So back then, so he actually thought of philosophizing as something as having therapeutic value as well as simply just putting you in touch with the truth. But in the early 20th century, a couple of things happened. Number one is philosophy got hyper interested in science as a model and wanted to become not interested in healing, but just interested in determining the truth. And we sort of just, philosophy shed a lot of its, of what was once psychology, and psychology sprung up to fill the gap. And the two disciplines kind of drifted apart a little bit, but they were originally joined at the hip.
Yeah. I mean, I could see that. I mean, I even subscribe to an APA, an American Psychological Association journal called the Journal of Theoretical and Philosophical Psychology, which is that is sort of the corner of psychology that interests me the most, is where there is so much overlap. It's cool to know that that's also happening within philosophy movement.
Yes. So you may have come across a book called Plato, Not Prozac.
I haven't, but I need to add that to my list. Yeah, I love like it.
So its author, Lou Marinoff, has basically been, you know, sort of single-handedly, but he's been working very hard to help philosophers, people who are trained in philosophy, but who want to actually help solve practical problems.
Mm-hmm.
How do you help people use philosophy to just help them with the issues they're wrestling with? I mean, it used to be that was a straightforwardly philosophical thing. You'd go to talk to your village philosopher or something, or your village sage if you
right.
had a lot of these issues. And it was only much later that psychology kind of became a distinct discipline. But just being able to have a really good, deep conversation with good listening and people asking the right questions, that can have enormous therapeutic value. And I think CBT and what I forget all the other variations on mm-hmm. CBT that you know about, but I think that's a tribute, right, to that basic idea. It's just that I think some philosophers want to get back in that same game.
Well, and it almost sounds, you know, to kind of come full circle, like in many ways, that's the sort of motivation for the work that you did in your book was, you know, this idea of solving practical problems utilizing a philosophical frame of reference. You know, how can we understand why people believe things that do not serve us as a society, and how do we boost
prevent
our immunity
that
from against them?
And yeah. How do we prevent that from just tearing apart the world our children and our grandchildren will occupy? So in the book, I argue that the famous Socratic method, where you test ideas with questions and see how they do, that's one of the most powerful mind inoculants ever invented. And I actually think that your standard course in critical thinking, the standard approaches to critical thinking, are only doing a tiny fraction of what they need to be doing for a hyper-connected world.
So it's not enough to just say, hey, we're ahead of the curve here in our progressive university or our progressive Montessori school, because we teach critical thinking. It's like, yeah, but what is your critical thinking curriculum?
Exactly. What do you even mean by – so there was a study done in the California university system where the researchers basically asked several hundred university professors, do you teach critical thinking? And like 97% said yes. And they say, okay, well, what do you mean by critical thinking? And like 4 out of 5 of them didn't have the slightest idea how to define.
Right,
this
right.
thing that they were convinced, right? So, and it turns out that it's kind of a vague term that's a little bit of a black box. It kind of means, oh, you know, the way we educated liberal people like to think. And, you know, the way we think, that's critical, but the way they think, it's not. We kind of flatter ourselves with such thoughts a lot, but very few people have gone in and teased apart what they mean by critical thinking or come up with a kind of a coherent framework for teaching it. And I think my book is an attempt to sort of take critical thinking instruction to a whole new level by allowing us to see how the mind's idea filtration system, as it were, how it behaves like an immune system. And once you see that, you see hundreds of ways to strengthen our approach to critical thinking.
Yeah. So it's not just kind of taking what we know and adding a sort of frame or an analogy to it to help us better understand it, but it's also in doing it, it opens up the ability then to solve problems that we almost couldn't solve before because we couldn't quite define them.
That's right. And so questions like how should a dialogue between people from two different ideologies go? Like what are the ground rules? Well, turns out cognitive immunology has a really nice, elegant answer to that. Cognitive immunology says, you know what? There are probably ideas out there that are disrupting people's mental immune systems, because the same way there are biological immune disruptors, well, it turns out there are cognitive immune disruptors too. And you go out and you look for them, and lo and behold, they're there, and they spread, they circulate freely through our culture, diminishing our resistance to bad ideas. But we can shed those ideas and become, within a few years, substantially more immune to the worst forms of cognitive contagion.
Can I ask you one more example? I know we're starting to run over, and I still want to close with my big two questions that I ask everybody on the show. But can I ask you for another example that's been sort of in the back of my mind while we've been talking? Utilizing the cognitive immunity frame, how do you grapple with the idea of authority? Because I think we're living in a world now where you hear this phrase thrown, like bandied about, like, do your own research, which is sort of this ridiculous, like, oh, study everything there is to study yourself, go open your own lab, like run your own Gallup poll. Like, at a certain point, it becomes ludicrous. And so the argument, of course, always is, well, there are people who have expertise in areas, and we have to have some amount of a trust in authority that these individuals who went through the academic training and the rigors of certification and, you know, getting their licenses to practice whatever they practice, that they have expertise. But then you have people who say, yeah, but that's not my expert. This person over here is my expert.
Right. So for a long time, we've been telling kids, think for yourself. And mm-hmm. in fact, one of the mantras of the critical thinking movement is don't just buy into groupthink, think for yourself. Well, it turns out that that's remarkably confusing advice, in part because the best thinking is highly collaborative. What makes science such a powerful engine of truth and insight and understanding is that many, many people help to point out each other's mistakes, and they end up doing something that no one of them could have done alone. So I like to say that mental immunity is a team sport. You have to have collaborators who are willing to poke holes in your arguments, and you know, smilingly poke holes in theirs, and you try to help each other see the flaws in the ideas you're relying on. So the people who are out there doing their own research, in some ways, they're just following the advice that the whole critical thinking paradigm has been pushing on people. They're going out and doing their own research. What they don't have is a support network of experts that can keep their thinking and their inferences anchored in reality. So if you go out and do your own research and you discover some quack who's, you know, peddling, you know, pseudoscientific remedies, a lot of times you'll be swept up in it and think you've and end up paying a lot of money for a worthless.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's such a common thing that you see. As you were saying that, I was pulling up a meme that I shared on my Instagram like a couple of months ago. Somebody put it together. It says, I did my own research, but it has three footnotes, right? So I did, footnote one, watched my own, footnote two, someone else's research, footnote three, shitty YouTube video. And that's, you know, and that's really sometimes the frustration. It's like, no, why do you believe this random person who, I guess, based on your frame, has face validity? They're making an argument that right. seems, as we would say using Simpson speak, cromulent to you.
Cromulent,
but
okay.
Yeah, that's a made up word from The Simpsons, but it works okay. So perfectly there. Like it just seemed like it makes so much sense to you because they're speaking your language, but eschewing, you know, thousands of hours of funded academic research and mm-hmm. and like consensus among experts across multiple continents and just this. Oh, it's so frustrating. But at the same time, it's obviously something we need to figure out how to work with.
Right. Well, and I think many of us in higher education, you know, we're the kind of geeky folks who did well in school and our teachers validated us. And so it was easy for us to kind of, you know, say, oh, I'm going to keep at this because, you know, these folks make me feel good about myself, so you stay in it.
For sure. It's an enormous amount of privilege to have been able to get, you know, an advanced degree. Even if you struggled, there's an enormous amount of privilege that comes from all of the things working just right to be in that position where you have that academic knowledge.
And there are a whole lot of people who feel left out of that system of privilege, right? And
yeah,
they're very angry. And they're right now, I think they're going to their own sources their own experts, in part to just say, you know, fuck you to the whole system that in some cases didn't serve them well, or chewed them up and spit them out, or told them they were dumb, or, you know, whatever else.
Yeah, I completely agree. So okay, gosh, there's so much more I wish I could talk to you about. But of course, there's also so much more in the book. So before we close with our last two questions, just one more big shout out, guys. You've got to pick up the book, Mental Immunity. So Andy, before we wrap up, is there anything else that we didn't touch on that?
I will mention one thing. Mm-hmm, yeah. So in the wake of the book's publication a few months ago, there's been a lot of interest in this concept of cognitive immunology that I've been promoting. And people who study how to inoculate minds have been saying, Andy, there ought to be a research institute that really goes deep on this and generates solutions that, you know, how do we get to a world where humanity has herd immunity to cognitive contagion? How do we get from here to there? So I basically founded this research institute. I call it the Cognitive Immunology Research Collaborative. And the acronym is CIRCE, C-I-R-C-E. And we're off to an amazing start with a lot of top researchers signing on. And we've got a benefactor has come out of the woodwork to get us a nice starting gift. And I expect I'll be promoting this science and trying to chart a path to, you know, a world freed of, you know, crazy outbreaks of unreason. And I think the relevant knowledge is now coming into focus, but it needs to be distilled and shared in ways that everyone can put to use.
Yeah. And I just, as you were telling me about it, I just found your website, cognitiveimmunology.net, and you can read about, it looks like, the key concepts, the evidence, you know, the different individuals who have been involved, applied cognitive immunology, how it actually works in real life. I love this.
Thanks. And if your listeners are interested in getting involved or in supporting our work, please check out the site and be in touch.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, great, great. And so, okay, last little bit of business. When I have a new guest on the show, I always ask them the same two closing questions. And now we're, you know, 7 years and let's see, gosh, I'm looking at my list here, 378 episodes
wow.
deep. I know. And I'm curious where you're going to go with these. So these are big picture questions. You're, as a philosopher, clearly a big picture thinker. So I want you to answer. Right. I want you to answer in whatever context is relevant to you. So this could be based on your work in mental immunity. It could be based on something more personal or even something much larger and more cosmic and even kind of beyond the human condition.
All right.
So the first thing is, what is the thing that's been keeping you up the most at night? The thing you're most concerned about, maybe worried? We might even throw in terms like cynical or you know, pessimistic about. And then on the flip side of that, where are you finding genuine, authentic hope? Where are you finding optimism these days? What do you look forward to?
Fascinating. So I got an email from a good friend a few days ago saying, Andy, the news has got me so depressed. The country is being torn apart. We're destroying the planet and causing species to go extinct at a crazy rate. You know, talk me off the ledge, Andy. Talk me off the ledge. And I mean, I don't know that I have the solution to this. And all of those same things keep me awake at night, right? So, well, I should say this. I actually sleep pretty well these days, but I do worry a lot about those things. One of the points I made to this friend who reached out for help is that we can make a distinction between hope and expectation. So I'm not sure I can rationally expect the whole climate change issue to resolve itself well, but I can sure as heck hope that it will. And I think that while it's important not to adjust our beliefs based on what we want to be true, I think we can adjust our hopes based on what we want to be true. So resolute hopefulness, I think, is a wonderful quality. People who are just determined to remain upbeat and hopeful and positive in their outlook. I admire that trait so much. And I actually think that the concept of faith, its best use is to promote resolute hopefulness.
Interesting. And, you know, I see this sometimes with my, with the patients that I work with who are struggling with these life-limiting illnesses, some of them who are going to die. And the idea that they're going to somehow miraculously beat, advanced metastatic diagnosis is out of the realm of reality for them. But what I notice that they often do, and we often talk about, is that they hope for the best while preparing for the worst. So they don't delude themselves into thinking they don't need to prepare.
Yes.
But they're so hopeful, they don't assume the worst will happen.
Yeah, and I think you can actually practice hoping. I think hope is something that can respond to practice. And it can actually be brought at least partially under the will.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think, you know, it's there's that fine line, right? Like I think that's why things like The Secret and like manifesting your bank account and things like that are so attractive to people, because there is a kernel of truth in it. Of course, if you maintain a certain type of mindset, you will be able to find the motivation to achieve the goals that you're setting and things like that. So if you're never hopeful, if you're always really pessimistic and down on yourself, you may not even find that internal motivation to do the things or to find the outcomes that you were hopeful for. At the same time, there is that point where it's like that toxic positivity where you go, okay, we got to come back to reality. Like, you know, we can't hope ourselves into, you know, a full meal at dinner time. We still have to like cook it.
Yeah, I'm a big favor of realism when it comes to belief and optimism when it comes to, I don't know, mood or
right.
And to the extent that you can reconciling those isn't always easy, right? If you try to be realistic about a world that's pretty messed up while simultaneously remaining upbeat and hopeful, that can be tricky, but it can be done. And some of the wisest people in the world, I think, managed to pull it off. I think I've just been talking to a meditation expert who basically says, you know, mindfulness meditation can help you do this, that hopefulness is something you can learn.
Yeah, I think so. And I think a lot of it does come from these ideas that we've been discussing about, you know, accepting yourself, about utilizing empathy, about, like you mentioned before, doing kind things for the people who you care about as a form of feeling more connected. And I do think all of that is part of the mindfulness movement. And it's part of this idea of maintaining a radical sense of hope for the future, while at the same time being a rational, realistic, dare I say, critical thinker.
Hey, one other thought on this I want to share with you, Kara. Have you come across Rutger Bregman's book, Humankind?
Humankind. Let me look it up. I want to see the cover. This is
he's a Dutch historian.
Rutger Bregman. I see. Okay. No, I haven't.
So he argues that our picture of human nature has a decisive effect on how we behave. And when we have a dour, cynical view of human nature, it tends to bring out the worst in us. And when we have a positive, more hopeful picture of human nature, it tends to bring out the best in us.
I get that. I feel that. I feel like sometimes people will ask me, hey, do you believe in karma? And I'm like, well, I'm not religious, so I don't think that there's some sort of like cosmic, you know, judger who's saying, oh, you were bad there, so I'm going to do bad things to you now. But I believe in karma insofar as if you're an asshole all the time, people are going to start being an asshole back to you.
Well, Bregman does a beautiful job of showing that assholery is far less common than we tend to think. And yeah, so it turns out human beings are pretty damn decent if you really look hard at the evidence. And I mean, there are exceptions, right? But it's easy to spend 10 times as much time thinking about the exceptions and ignoring the vast sea of decency that's all around us.
I think you're so right. I mean, and our media does such a great job of only highlighting the exceptions. And
Yes, of course,
there's this huge, huge sampling bias there. Gosh, Andy, I can't thank you enough for A, for writing this book, B, for doing the work that you do, C, for taking the time to share it all with us, and even little things like the book recommendation. I mean, I feel like this is so meaningful for me personally, and hopefully for the people listening to the show.
That's so kind of you to say, Karen. Yeah, it's been a pleasure for me too.
Oh, good, good. These are the interviews that I'm just, it reminds me why I do this. So thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I hope we'll get a chance to do it again.
Absolutely. Everybody, the book is Mental Immunity, Infectious Ideas, Mind Parasites, and the Search for a Better Way to Think by Dr. Andy Norman. And thank you all for joining me week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.